my first time here, so I'm a bit nervous. Anyway, this is called Let Me Run. Winter. It's like waiting for the stubborn wound to heal before you can rip off the scab and jump off your slow crutches into summer. Let me out on the paths to run till I have to pace in the bushes and feel the toxins sweat from my tiredness with each step. Couch long forgotten in the midst of a January storm, with flashes of bluebells and golden daffodils whizzing past my blind spot. Running on and on, heart beating and tunes pulsing in my ears. Let me run over puddles and between ditches. Let my newborn legs run, under big strong branches stretching up their giant embrace, gnarling overhead my tunnel as I race through to tomorrow. Each day scratched off my calendar, every chore stacked away and ready for the next one. Ready to finish that end of term, that next promise. I jet towards a new beginning, over and under and through each evening. Every hunted bear walloped aside, out of my way. Every snide comment hurtled over, and every setback nifty dodged and propelled on and on and up and higher to my goals. And I breathe, short, deep, gasping, happy breaths, muscles stretched and pain soothed by a rewarding hot shower. Embalmed and cozy, I crawl back to the winter couch and rest in shadows. And wait for the next one, the next run, bringing me closer and closer to that finish line garden in full bloom. Come on, summer, spring and I are flexing for your return.
Keep coming, summer, keep coming, take the rain away. Deirdre O'Brien.
About this time last year, below in Garrettstown, where it was bleak and it was deserted and there was nothing else to do but write a poem about it. So it's called The Sea. This giant sleeps eternally, a restless, moving sleep, breathes heavy and deep, pounding breaths that overreach the washed up debris on the beach. Too far, you breathe too far, too late, you drown in an instant in a shallow rock pool, your water still and ready to stagnate here at my feet. There is a cold and cutting wind and a lone seagull beats an exit overhead. Now you are a murky green, pierced by breakers, sharp and clean. The sun breaks through the clouds' distress, you reflect it instantly in a dazzling silver dress, and invite me in to sink or swim. But on this rock, wind and rain in my face, one slip now and I'm out of the race, out of my depth at any rate. And what is that, 5'2"? With heels maybe 5'7" or 8"? We're way beyond my comfort zone, and I'm thinking like the seagull, will I just beat an exit home? Then you offer me your optical illusion, to pin my hopes on your far-off confusion. That special place where sky and sea look like they meet but don't. I want to reach your horizon, but I won't. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great stuff. Joe Sweeney.
Whoa.
Cool.
Three minutes, I forgot my novel. We were in church at Mass, and you went up for communion, and you came back, and you went into the wrong seat. This piece is called Purgatory. You remain kneeling, keeping your eyes closed tight, maintaining a reverent posture. You have a niggling suspicion that something is wrong. You open your eyes. The woman next to you is now wearing a green coat, and she looks older than a few minutes ago. And there are now three children in the seat in front, looking at you as if you were from Mars. Slowly, horribly, you realize you're a terrible mistake. You are in the wrong seat. You freeze. Maybe nobody else will notice. Maybe you'll get away with doing nothing. The honest thing to do would be to stand up like a man, admit your mistake, and go back where you belong. You have been known to be manly in the past, but you're prepared to be a mouse now until the end of Mass. You decide to lie low. This is a bad decision. The die is now cast. You close your eyes again and hold a posture that you feel no Christian could dream of disturbing. You try to appear lost in the divine presence. Unfortunately, the pew you have chosen is all booked up. and its rightful occupants are now coming back. The return of each communicant rings your knell. There are an awful lot of them. You can't believe that so many people could fit in such a confined space. You're right, they can't. There is one person too many, and you are the one. Bit by bit, you are edged closer to the end until there is only room for one knee on the footrest. The other one is now hovering in midair. If people secretly feel sorry for you, they show no sign of it. There's no point in blaming them. This is not a matter of religion now. It is a matter of science. The seat is not big enough. You'll have to go. Nothing could be more excruciating. The rightful tenants stare straight ahead heartlessly as you stumble free. You try to effect your exit like it was the most natural thing in the world. Unfortunately, you trip over a lady's handbag and nearly impale yourself on a decorative piece of cornicing on the confessional box. Returning to your proper seat, you stand at the end, asking to be let back. The people there are not enthusiastic about your return. They're not sure they want to be associated with losers like you. You stand there like the prodigal son, dreaming of fatted calves. Unfortunately, your former neighbours are not feeling paternally towards you. They are in fact a bunch of bad Samaritans, and instead of reaching out a helping hand, they ignore you in the hope that you will go away. They do not recognise you as one of them. Besides, they have been enjoying the extra space and find your reappearance unsettling. With the greatest of reluctance, they shuffle to make room for you, but not with any amazing grace. You get in quickly, out of the public glare, and duck down. The priest starts the final prayer. You are praying too. You are praying that your trial of embarrassment will end soon. Unfortunately, a missionary nun has asked to be allowed to make a special appeal for starving Africans. Her goodwill and enthusiasm know no bounds, and it's a full 10 minutes later when she finally reluctantly winds up and the mass ends. Like a soul released from purgatory, a pigeon escaping from a dovecote, you join the throng, making hurriedly for the exit. As you finally get out the door, you feel such relief you could laugh, but you don't. Once the pressure to be serious is gone, you no longer feel the urge to laugh. I bet God does.
So, if I could give you 30 minutes, I would. And next up, Emily Davis Fletcher.
Oh, hey!
I hate going after Joe. Joe'll know how unwitty I am and how short I am. So this is called, this is titled Mom Calls, I Inform Her She's Been Missing for a Week. And send the voice of the mother. Call the police and ask. I was found at the train station when I was 3, trying to buy a ticket to see my pawpaw. The sheriff said I was going to be sold for my hair, turned white blonde like cotton, after Dad gave up his promotion, moved us down to Tucson, because she made the doctor think Uncle Larry had asthma. I told the sheriff she wasn't my mother, but she got me, put me on a leash, and wrote iodine in breezy letters on the backs of my baby pictures. I'm not seen in any photos till my wedding day. But I'm not missing. I'm here, in this long gray hall. It's so bright, the floors and walls look slick. The windows won't open in case we slip and fall out. Honey, not a hospital. I'm not hurt. This is a hotel, the moon. I'm just traveling through.
And that was always Emily. Next, Owen Murray.
There we are.
This is called Siddhartha. I wrote it not long after reading Siddhartha by Vernon Hesse.
Oh.
But
I read it too, yeah.
It's good, yeah.
It's a great novel.
I'm not sure the connection will be very apparent though, but anyway.
Mental institutions, degradations of the soul, cesspits where the body screams for recognition. The flies want to make love to me. I dance with the pieces of the puzzle, awaiting their alignment. Patients scream at doctors, deafened by the corridors, who know who will be coming back, who won't, who choose to shit on the streets and scream so they can get a comfy bed. And the beds are comfy, and the mind is numbed, the self is denied. Some relief is obtained. The doctor flies check that I'm alive until I slap them. The flies, they whisper in my ear, they tickle, they land and retreat, they want me like a passion. They want my body, they make love, they tease, they dance into my eyes, they dance before my eyes, they want to taste my blood. Kids cycle past, laughing, fully clothed ignorance. I agonize for fully clothed ignorance. They numb the mind, create crutches, build prisons out of life, toxic hiding holes, chemical respite. O Satyarma, O Siddhartha.
It's always great to see new people come up and do something that's just like really wow. Okay, cool. Yeah, you're coming back. Next up, Seamus Harrington.
Today I got another cold call, so I'll drag this out again. Cold call. Your precious time for a moment or two. Your service provider is currently who? Our latest rendition, because of attrition, we're in a position to offer free minutes and modems to you, and channels as clear as a didgeridoo.
Okay.
Preventative maintenance. This is for the people who don't like rhyming. The poetry police. Yeah. Preventive maintenance. It is soothing like a hare, floating lightly on still air, views forming layer by layer, incremental as a stair, no strident brash fanfare, decremental as a stair. Become an extra pair, you'll deem it very fair, outlaw, outlay is so small to bear, to proffer part of life's fare. No, it's wrong, just half a pair, yet each one's still a player. To the start we'll now repair, as we may become aware, while ignoring each naysayer. It's quite normal to prepare, certainty to lay so bare, at phantoms to fold and tear, with thoughts to gladly share. Involve no wish to overbear, candid nuggets, then a layer of the word, one more purveyor, no cause for wise soothsayer, of the truth, one more relayer. All this you could declare, even located at the rear, by order through the chair. I'll go write one if you dare, because a poem is just a prayer.
Hey.
Nice to see such poetry there. And next up we have Rob Carlisle.
Hi, this is very fresh, so I'm not positive what it's called, but we'll go with On Bad Poetry Part 1. Heartbreak is healthier than television. Regret is the spice of memory, and action trumps inaction. So write bad poetry. Write despite disinterest, disillusionment, disenchantment, detestation. Despite compromised concentration, poor preparation, or other obligation. Despite the shy remuneration, defy expectation, and change the rhyme scheme randomly, without explanation or justification. Use unusual allegory, understood by select few, i.e. you. Use abstract, meaningless metaphors and masturbation. A pleasurable sensation in privacy and poetry. Pepper paragraphs with plosives. What poem would oppose you? You're supposed to. It's post-new way, post-modern oration. It shows preparation. Alliteration? Absolutely. Always an approved addition. Abandon all aversion. Amply its application. Abuse it an absurd amount. Remember the ABCs and brave cowardice and bad cause and be confusing. Always be censoring. Don't ever frighten grandmothers. Have a decent jokes. Kids like them. Never overstay. Perform quickly. Research. Sounds. Thesauruses. Useless vocabulary. Wordsworth. Xanadu. Yeats. Zen. Insert a haiku. Start people's fingers twitching. Counting syllables. Talk inarticulate shit. Perform linguistic tricks. Sing with sticks. Show off awkwardly. Vocabulary. Verbosity. Be pompous and rude. Mix truth and lies. Use words unwisely and unwell. Marry heaven and hell. Beg, borrow, steal and sell out. Shout. Leave poems half finished, unfinished, nowhere near finished. Write constantly, prolifically, sporadically, rarely, uncaringly. Start sharing experiences. It's about communication, so be patient. Write despite disenchantment, detestation, and repetition. Be inefficient. Make your mission to say nothing by saying something, or say something by saying nothing, because everyone exists in a state of unrest. Everyone's experience is of interest when well expressed, and all it tests, it's best to confess the peace and panic in thy breast. It takes stress off your chest, and that fell mess might cry, yes, that is me, I too see it that way, the decay, the dismay, and the grey, every day, you're already cliches and all in a way. In children's book rhyme schemes, in blank verse, pale or purple prose, say something, say something, say something, if you get around to it.
I think we actually just heard the same poem in two different styles. Anyway, next up we have our 5-word winner, Cedric.
Okay, this one is called Quantum Entanglement, inspired by our guest and his story, I guess. Your state is mine, as we spin, alike and separated. Our estate wouldn't be fine, had it not been thoroughly calculated. The forces that tie us together are a minute, structured amount of those that are united yet clashing over and over, creating shockwave nothing can oppose. Our association is unnatural, somehow carefully self-handcrafted, for the result of this experiment is vital to allow further experiences to be accumulated. Dark and light, necessary extremes, two absolute states of one kin. From deep black to pasty white, all supreme, quantic, entangled fates, separated only by the color of the skin.
Very nice. Next up, Helen Harrison. Helen.
I don't know, you've all probably heard of you'll obviously know the online competition, 5 words. I answered it many times. But, and there's a few poems from 5 words. And this one, I think the words were tattoo, ink, purple, plaster, and ring. And I did a Tezzorima, my first Tezzorima. So, unwept. Like a fly into your spidery tattoo, I flew, immersed myself in your scent. Ink tributes of love in purple grew, engraved on you my love attempts. Created an air of artful pleasing, woven symbols of all that love meant. Melting hours and smouldering teasing, as ever deeper into your web I drew. Plastered passion as a seasoning, over time that purple turned to blue. The odour of lust came and went. Knowing I'd fallen out of love with you, I returned the gold ring you had sent. New familiarity had bred contempt. And here's one, I just couldn't think of a poem for this, so I did a sort of nonsense poem. The words were garrotted. How do you say it? Garrotted. Garrotted. Had to look it up, you know. Garrotted. A bit. Collar, drain, and gosh, lust, I forget, but gutted. I was the fish you hauled with a passion as I wriggled trust into your palm, your belly tickling, teasing, gave me reason for feeling safe in your salt of the earth seasoning. Though soon your love became spite when other men set their sights on me. You accused me of lust, refusing my trust, and your steaming resentment drained me. Agitation caused dehydration. In dry drops of dread, I tried to escape, but you sharpened your knife to seal my fate. Any movement I made, making you roar with hate. Possessed by ownership, you sliced and sliced your collared catch, until only memories were left of the love you had spiced, of the fish now garrotted, stiff in death and floated, down the river, belly up and bloated. Nourishment or practice. I crafted. The words here were ears, jars, tap, wit, blow, something. Right, crafted. This is about this place. Quenched by craft beer and poetry on tap, upstairs in the Long Valley Bar, I filled my jar, and ears to the swelling crowd of read out loud. Words randomly chosen, begging to be heard, poems from the profound to the absurd. Some dreary as a dripping tap, but always a laugh. The soft fallen, the appealing, the stripped and revealing, as the burst from brow to pen races on, the audience embrace. And words pour like sap in a maple forest, with the beat of the drums and the lush rap as the well deepens. And many gems appear from the sensual to the dark, making me glad I embarked at Cork Harbour to the McNamara Slam. As they fight for first place through powerful sentences, bravado and grit, pleasure, sorcery, wisdom, and loads of wit, and plenty of words which rhyme with it. Some inventions may be outrageous, even blue, but the hayloft mix is electric all night through.
So true. Next up is Anton Floyd, and I just remind you guys again, we're going to start coming up to our time very quickly, so short little one. So, Anton Floyd.
This is called My Take on the Angel of History by Walter Benjamin, which is on Paul Klee's painting Angelus Novus, the new angel. See his angel of history with wings outspread, turn to face the past, and stare open-mouthed at the single catastrophe. His world lies wrecked before him, all is ruin. Though he looks fixedly, he sees memories fading, blown from view. That storm in paradise that raged in the past, he sees it raging still. The angel cannot stop it, wants to but cannot stay. Wants to redeem our state from the mere mind and the leaden heart, wants to make whole what is dashed and lost. But his wings are caught in the maelstrom. It propels him backwards, irresistibly out of time, leaving us to progress. Under the piling ash that grows skywards, minute by minute, we sift from the debris vestiges of hope.
Next up is Lavisa Cusgrave.
Hi, I'd like to share this book by Don McGeese. It was given as a gift, and I just discovered it this morning again. So I'll begin first with an introduction. One morning in 1916, newspaper man Don McGeese discovers a cockroach jumping about on the keys of his office typewriter, tapping out a poem letter by letter. The cockroach is Archie, a free verse poet in a previous life. From Archie's poem, he learns that Cat Mehibel was once Cleopatra. Thus begins a literary legend, the comic rantings of Archie, whose poems use no capital letters because the cockroach could not work the shift key on his boss's typewriter. So, this is a very short one. Titles, What Next? Transmigration of souls is a great game if you do not weaken, but every now and then I get worried about my future. I used to be a verse-lib poet before my ego went into the body of a cockroach. And sometimes I turn pale with the thought that I may be going further down. Yet before I start to climb back, I might even be a hat check boy in a hotel, Archie.
They say if there was a nuclear war, a poet would be the only creature to survive.
Next up, we have Nadine.
Am I reading right? Nadine?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Since brevity is strong, it would please the man is very short.
I said short.
It's called One, like. Dark is the sun, cold the light. Come up, moon, save me, night. Blinding light, I cannot see. Cool days, leave me. Leave me, leave. Go, get lost, let me be. Shadow side, in solitude is bliss.
Okay, next up, I think I'm reading this right, is this Max Creed?
Max
Creed, yeah. Max Creed? Yeah, okay. My eyesight's getting worse.
Yeah. I won't talk to you with my five word at the time, but I'll keep it short and sweet. This is a little bit of a sad one, and I had it very simple, but I was told it didn't make sense. So this is a story of my dad, and my dad was a monk. So it's quite extraordinary, really. I was there for three times that he nearly met his maker, and he didn't need. So I hope it isn't too dreary, but it is an anniversary today. So my dad was a Franciscan once, until he got the scruples, and home he came from Multi Farnham and fathered 14. He was, I said to him, monks make for great fathers, Dad. But they're very kind of sophisticated, and they have rhetoric. And then, where would you be if I'd stayed? So he was a miller, a merchant, and a hotelier, but he was proudest of being the first, because the mill wheel still rolls from the misty lee by the big bridge. The tradition was so long, he called his grown grain his Viking ration. But he still fancied himself as a bird charmer, being Franciscan, and he brought in the oats every day to his birds, and they literally would talk to him, but he always kept a canary. They go, he says, girl, with the falling of the trees and the budding of the leaves. And they go on trees, the soul passes, and when the third one is gone, Legs, you can relax for another bit, it'll be fine. And if I had three wishes, I'd have Boston Lava, nice and fast, and I'd go at the Lord's time, that'd be a great privilege. So I said, I hope you get three wishes, Dad. So down he went to my sixth spring, moving horizontal in a stretcher through our shop. My daddy carried, his eyes were near mine, and his fingers touched mine. I leave soon, my little princess, he said. You'll have to mind your mammy for me. But I refuse his wish because I had a wish of my own to glide with him by my side up the aisle. Well, they put the life back into with no fancy bypass, fingers of toast, boiled eggs and cortisone. They shrank him 4 stone in 2 weeks. Home he came and back up the stairs. So, delirious then, I sat with him in his Ginzano, in the Sisi, in his heaven. No, Daddy, you're here beside me, and my baby pudgy hands reached up to grasp his. Sitting on the icy metal safe box, I draw him rashers and toast and plenty tea. But again, down he went, on my eighth autumn. And again I kissed his icy purple lips goodbye, in cold antiseptic rooms where no child should ever tread. This time she brought him a golden double blanket when he came home, with satin edges, and she'd say, do you know, John, 'tis fit for his tailor to emerge from in Cleopatra. That was her favourite film. And she'd notions they'd resume everything as normal. She was only 50. It was full of Egyptian or Hellenic seas. And I said, do you know,
He never missed a canary. The poor old canary was sacrificed in his absence. And sure, there was a big run to the coal cave to get a decoy. But it didn't work at all. After the repositioning, he just said, "Where's my Ronnie gone? That fella's tuneless." So true. And I will speed up because I'm running out of time. Despite it all, there was a slow incursion into his little monastic cell next door because his feet were icy cold. I was stuck in the middle of the two, and she smelt of too much olivulae and germaline. So he moved into his little cell gently and sadly, and I was drafted in for the parting of the pair. And all his had is his sacred pictures and his lives of saints, and he became what I loved him to be, a theologian, an astronomer, and a genealogist. He had the books in his roll-top bureau, and he went through them with me. So then there was the final thud. And we put his body down, and petechia pinpricks formed their telltale signs, and we said, "Don't go and don't leave us." But still we blew and pushed to crunch. "No more Santino," no, said his lady with the china blue eyes, touching the frosted glass of his bedroom door. My breath, his last inflation, said farewell for his soul's expiration, and a father's blessing from his bed, so very fast, and on the resurrection day. 'Twas actually, he died on Holy Saturday. So, slop.
That was lovely, nice. Thank you very much. Next, Patricia Walsh.
I don't know how many of you were here last week. I read out my first attempt at a haiku. And now it's my second attempt at a haiku. It's called Antibiotics and Antipsychotics. Antibiotics and more antipsychotics. It's strange I still live. Thanks.
We're only mad for haikus in the Long Valley, aren't we? Right, next up, Mary O'Connell.
Hi, Shane. As Easter approaches, I have pulled this out, which I haven't done for quite a while. It's not a poem, it's a kind of a monologue, and it's called Humpty Dumpty's Existential Monologue. Bent under the yoke of isolation on this high and windy wall, I cannot help dwelling on the problem of my girth, which alas keeps constantly expanding. I have tried all sorts of diets, egged on by my spouse, who makes valiant efforts to cut down on my consumption. My problem is I can never get enough. Neighbors chatting 19 to the dozen make constant comments about my weight. And while it certainly is a fertile topic of conversation, I fear that the charge of exhausting their patience may eventually be laid at my door. I follow a strict regime for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and then I chickle out. I realize I need to exercise a lot more, take up Pilates or go to the gym, but the last two options involve a lot of expense, and in truth, I find the whole thing too exacting. Now my sperm count has dwindled, and Mrs. Dumpty is extremely unhappy at the hope a future progeny might become extinct. Each time we look at a plate of scrambled eggs, she sighs and says, "There go our crazy mixed-up kids." I know I shouldn't beat myself up about it, but she has invoked the help of her hard-boiled brother. Last week he told me if I continued to expose myself to ridicule, by my gross self-indulgence, he would be forced to take drastic action. He actually said he believed I was cracking up. And suggested I leave the family home for sheltered accommodation.
Funniest thing I've heard you say, mate. I'm sorry, I love that. Next up, we have Jude O'Neill.
Hi. Instead of reading a poem this week, I'm going to sing a song instead.
My young love said to me, my mother, and my father won't slide you for your lack of kindness. And she's stepped away from me, and then she did say, it will not be long, love, till our wedding day. She stepped away from me, and she moved through the fair. And fondly I watched her move here and move there. Then she went her way homeward with one star away, as the swan in the evening moons over the lake. The people were saying, no to her way. But one has a sorrow that never was said. And I smiled as he passed me with gold and with gear. And that was the last that I saw I dreamt it last night, my true love came. So softly she entered, her feet made no din. Then she came close beside me, and this she did say, it will not be long, love, till our wedding day.
Thanks, everyone, a break from the poetry. And no, that was really nice, Jude. Thank you. Next up, Ciarán, who I believe is not going to sing.
I'm just gonna have to bang out a tune. No, I do. I just have a couple of announcements. Okay, quick announcement. Then you're around on Wednesday week, the eighth of April. We're having a fundraiser for the show that we're doing right now, so it's gonna be like a mixture of poetry and music. And yeah, it's gonna be on at 9 o'clock in the Slate. guys are around, do come down. I mean, some readers from here. This is a short little poem. Just a few poems. It's called To Wake and Walk. For you who values your existence, humanity, and the beauty of the universe, know that every time you leave the house or wake from your slumber and walk, you could meet a version of yourself that you didn't know. Thank you.
Okay, is Zen, do you want to do your piece, or? Okay, cool, good stuff. All right, so we got Zen, oh man, I have no idea how to pronounce your surname.
Savango.
Savango, right.
Okay, this is my first time doing this, so I'm a bit nervous. Okay, it's a poem for some bad relationship. And it's called A Castle on Quicksand. It was a small talk that set a spark to flames. They blossomed to a warm red. They changed motion, shaped love, and blazed with such energy. She smiled and spoke of cherishing the moment for the rest of her days. I lay there, admiring her beauty. Even Venus eyed her with envy. She stood by the windowsill, lit her cigarette, and inhaled. She blew the smoke. As I wish she would blow her regrets, her wrong, and inhale a new beginning. Instead, she concealed everything in her chest, for she feared demise to the flame. Even though she stood naked, she was covered in secret. Under the blanket, we became one. She kissed me goodnight, turned her back, and wet the pillow with tears of regret. Morning came. The sun shot its rays through the window. I opened my eyes to a beautiful smile. She confessed her love for me. Suddenly everything seemed brighter, but darkness lingered like a cloud of smoke, for she had chosen to build a new beginning on uncleared grounds. While I waited her confession, she already began on foundations. But I just couldn't let myself, though she perfected me like the last piece of a puzzle. What's perfection between two if honesty is lacking? What's a castle on quicksand? Thank you.
I love how when someone says it's their first time, the whole room just claps. That's just fantastic. It really is. It's so nice to see such support. And Zen, hopefully that's not your first and only time. Do come back. Thank you everyone for being so like awesome and quick, because we got through everybody except this last person. So hey, cool. Last one of the night. Afterwards, everybody probably heading to Mains as usual. I'll probably be heading to bed as usual. Some of us have to work. But anyway, no, sorry. So this last person, if he's still here, Joe McNulty.
This is a poem from a collection of poems called Dear Government. So if there's any politicians in the room, now would be a good time to leave. It's called Talking Revolution. Violence. Not necessarily the physical kind, more like the political kind. The kind that manipulates and suffocates the very essence of your soul. Now we're in a hole. And we put down our weapons and we've held out our hat. But all that we've got is increases in VAT. It worries me that. Maybe my idealism is too much for your secret capitalism. And we should keep our mouths shut. Bend over, and if you take us from behind, time after time after time after time, who pays for your crime? Who holds the receipt for the deceit and the treason, for the betrayal of trust and the bankers corrupt, for leading us up the garden path of moss and heather and briars, defined by cheats and liars, and a hegemonic system of power that grows stronger from hour to hour to power. But this is our country, and this is our land, and no longer will we stand with our hat in our hand, nor grovel at the feet of the men who cheat. We need a release. And I'm not just talking retribution. No. I'm not just talking retribution. I'm talking fucking revolution.
Woo!